Good evening and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, January 31st, 2010. My name is James Marino, and on the call this evening, we are joined by Matthew Murray and Peter Felicia. Matthew can be found at talkonbroadway.com, where he's the chief theater critic and also is a columnist for Broadway Stars. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, James.
Also with us, we have Peter Felicia. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com and also is a writer for the Newark Star Ledger. Hey, Peter.
Good evening.
So last week we talked a little bit about Present Laughter and A View from the Bridge, but Peter hadn't seen the shows yet, so I want to get Peter to weigh in on, we'll start with Present Laughter. Peter, what'd you think?
Well, I think it's an awfully overwritten play. I wish it was shorter. I think that Noel Coward makes the point that Gary Essendine does have a lot of visitors that keep on driving him crazy for one reason or another, that he can't get anything done because people are always barging in on him. I'm sure this actually came from Coward's own experience being pursued by so many people in his life, if not pursued by a bear, but by so many. So as a result, I understand where he was coming from and what probably motivated him to write this play, but it's just too long. It's not a bad production there at the theater. It's Victor Garber is quite good in the role, and I enjoyed some of the supporting performances. Brooks S. Manskis has got a great deal of criticism for being a little too over the top. He may have calmed down by the time I saw him. He certainly was over the top, but I found it consistent with the character. So for me, the main problem was just that the point was made early and then just kept on being made over and over again that this guy was being bothered much too much. And we all know how that is. But nevertheless, a little of that went a long way for me.
And Peter, you mentioned it last week, but you know, how many other productions did you see of Present Laughter?
My first one was in 1974 at the Kennedy Center in Washington, where I saw Douglas Fairbanks Jr. play it. I did see the George C. Scott production in the 80s and the Frank Langella production in the 90s. So this was my fourth. And as I get older, I seem to have a little less tolerance for it. It's something I don't need to see again.
Alice Duffy, who was in Present Laughter, Peter, do you know who I'm talking about? She's the... The older woman that's in Present Laughter, she's an 81-year-old mom and actress, and she's making her Broadway debut. And I saw this on NBC, and I thought that was quite a feat to make a. So your theater world
was. If this is her Broadway debut, I guarantee you she'll be on the ballot because we do recognize Broadway debuts. And it doesn't matter how old you are. I love when it happens, by the way. Deanna Dunnigan, when she won her Theater World Award, made a big point of saying, wow, I'm the oldest one here, and here I am among all these young people. But in essence, if you haven't appeared on Broadway or off Broadway, it's never too late to win a Theater World Award. I didn't think she was that old. She does have the proper demeanor. Did you feel, Matthew?
I like her. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, you know, she'll be on the ballot, and we'll see if the seven judges give her enough votes to make it happen. So we'll see. But I'm glad you brought that to my attention, James.
Yeah,
that,
it's very interesting, and I happened to catch the article, and I said, wow, I'd love to make a mention of it. We didn't get you to weigh in yet on A View from the Bridge because you hadn't seen it yet. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, James, I'm going to ask you a question first. Do you come from a totally Italian-American background? Marino suggests Italian-American, but was your mother an Italian-American as well?
No. Uh-huh. Sure, in Scotland.
Frankly, taking a look at you, I didn't think so. But nevertheless, yes, I come from a very Italian background. Though my parents were both born in this country, their parents had not been. And indeed, my mother and father were very, very Italian and identified with being Italian far more than American. So I was really impressed by View from the Bridge for getting all the Italian stuff right. The gestures were just perfect. You always hear about how Italians talk with their hands. And there was a lot of eloquence going on up there. I really recognized so many of those gestures as being ones I had seen around my kitchen and dining room table when my relatives used to come to visit. So I think they got the Italian stuff really right. I thought it was, I agree with most of the critics. I thought it was a very fine production. I was very impressed most of all, though, not by Liev Schreiber, not by Scarlett Johansson, who were both fine, no problems. You ain't going to hear any criticisms from me on them. But Jessica, heck, I didn't even recognize. I mean, I couldn't believe this was the lady I had seen at Blythe Spirit a little, maybe 2 years ago in Williamstown and so many other shows that I've seen her in, that she really was unrecognizable to me. I started looking in my program for an understudy slip, figuring I must have missed that because she sounded differently and looked differently. So she was really a revelation to me, and I really had a spectacular time watching her up there. Yes, I will admit that the Rudolfo that had to come in at a moment's notice may not have delivered the quintessential performances for Rudolfo, but he did the job. I like the guy who played Marco quite a bit. I think it's a very fine production of View from the Bridge, and I suspect of the six that I've seen, it's the one I like the best.
You know, talking about Jessica Hecht, she's somebody who seems to cross the television and Broadway boundary back and forth seamlessly. I constantly see her on television. I think that she was just on... oh, what was that show? Oh, I forget. I just saw her on television a few days ago. And then I was like, oh, but she's in A View from the Bridge. So obviously must have shot some time back. But I remember first seeing her in Last Night at Ballyhoo. And then, you know, seeing her everywhere ever since, you know, she really works all the time.
She does, you know, and it's really good because one wouldn't necessarily think that somebody who sounded or looked like her would be working all the time. It's not somebody that you tab and say, wow,
yeah,
that's a star. You know, I mean, and she has become one of our most valuable performers in terms of doing the job and getting out there. So it's really quite nice to see her doing so well.
She's very good. I guess my personal feeling, it wasn't that she was unrecognizable in this, just that she was doing a fine job. I thought that she was completely recognizable as herself, actually. And that's not any sort of a dig. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing if you can recognize someone from one production to another, as long as they change what they do to match the requirements of the role. And I thought that's what she did here. So yeah, she did good work.
Yeah, she's great. We love Jessica Hecht. So on to new stuff that we haven't talked about already. Time Stand Still opened up a few days back. And Matthew, why don't you give us an overview of that?
Well, this is the latest play by Donald Margulies, and it's got Laura Linney in it, who, of course, starred in Sight Unseen of his originally, and then, or she was a supporting role originally.
That's
and she
right.
moved up
yeah.
To the lead a few years back. And Brian mm-hmm. Darcy James, who was recently in Shrek and has done tons of other plays and musicals and everything else, is her boyfriend. They're mm-hmm. both journalists, but different kind of journalists. She is a photographer, and he is a freelance writer, and they both have a habit of going to war zones together and doing their magic on what they see there, with the hopes of informing people what the perils of war and violence and all that are like. And the most recent time that they went on one of these trips, she got caught in a roadside bomb and was in a coma for a while and has just recently got out of it and returned back to the United States, where she's trying to reorient herself to life and to life with her boyfriend, who she's been with for 8 years and has never married. But as soon as she has the near-death experience, he wants to get married, and she isn't sure whether that's what she wants, especially since they had been having a little bit of trouble before the accident. And there's a secondary couple with Eric Bogosian and Alicia Silverstone as his very, very young midlife crisis type girlfriend, who actually ends up being quite a bit more than that, and an interesting contrast to the Laura Linney character, in that she always looks at things very positively, maybe even too positively, and suggests that Laura Linney's character looks at things too negatively, because she thinks that showing the pain and death of the world is the only way to affect change. And Alicia Silverstone's character believes the opposite. I think it's a really nice blend of characters. It's a wonderful little story. It's not very complicated. It's not very long. It's just about 2 hours with an intermission. And there's not a lot of surprising stuff that happens, but it's very smartly constructed. And all of the characters except I think for Eric Bogosian, who's the actor is fine, but the character is a little bit underdeveloped. They all have very interesting points of view about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And the interplay of those works very well for me. It's not really like it's kind of a one-sided argument. You think the play is going that way with Laura Linney and Brian D'Arcy James opposite Alicia Silverstone, but then Alicia Silverstone sort of comes up and holds her own against them just in a different way. And it's nice to see something that avoids the kind of preachiness that we so often can associate with these kinds of stories. So it's a nice play. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's not groundbreaking, I guess, and it's not anything that's going to change very many people's lives, but it's a very tight little character drama with a couple of good laughs in it, and Laura Linney and Brian D'Arcy James are really excellent. So it's a good showcase for them if you like them, and hopefully you do because they're great performers. So yeah, I would recommend checking it out.
Yeah, I would too. I think it's a good play, maybe not a great play, but certainly a good one. One thing about Laura Linney, her character has been severely wounded. Her arm is in a cast, her leg is in a cast. More severe still, her face and neck have been scarred. They're terribly mottled. And when she takes off a jacket a little later, and you see her arm has been terribly mottled too. And later when Brian D'Arcy James wants to make love to her, she's reluctant to have him do it because she gives us the impression that her whole body looks quite terrible as a result of the experience she had over there. So that's something worth noting. What's also nice about Linney's performance is that she calibrates it very nicely in terms of dealing with Alicia Silverstone. By the end of the play, she really likes her on her own terms. While she's close to being very rude in the first scene to her, thinking that she's a bubble-headed bimbo, it's very nice how she adjusts to her as time goes on. So that's a nice change in her character. It's funny because I was asked to interview Eric Bogosian for the Star Ledger, which I did. And when I talked to him before I saw the play, I kept on noticing that he was talking about every other character but himself. And frankly, when I saw the play, I understood why. I'm echoing here what Matthew said about the character being underdeveloped. He is a middle-aged man who is dating a substantially younger woman, but you know, he's very sincere. He loves her for what she is and loves her for what she turns out to be as well. And they have the more successful relationship of the two. So that was kind of interesting to me. I didn't expect that to happen. What's good about the play? Now, this is a play where it really stresses that some people take their lives in their hands every second of every day while being in these war zones, while the rest of us are sitting in the Friedman Theater, you know, very comfortably watching this. Now, they could make us feel guilty about this, and Donald Margulies doesn't. He really makes it very clear that we all make choices, and if you make the choice that Laura Linney makes to get out there, you can really suffer terribly, and that one has to be aware of that. We all have to do what we've got to do. Some of us are made for this, some of us are not. That's the way Donald Margulies puts it out there. We don't blame Brian D'Arcy James for not being as heroic as Laura Linney. We see what it costs Laura Linney, not just in what happened to her physically, but also what happens in her romantic relationship. So I think the play is very good in painting a balanced picture, which is always my favorite thing when a play does that. It doesn't make one side look stupid or one side look vastly superior. Yeah, so one comes out of that theater asking a lot of questions and reassessing how we all feel about these things, but it doesn't make us feel worse than we need to feel about such matters, and I think that's very skillful.
Is this a limited run from MTC, or is this an open-ended run?
Everything in MTC is a limited run, I believe.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, though. On the Theatermania website, it does say that it's an open run, or at least it did. I noticed that. But certainly, when you go into the lobby, they tell you what else is coming. There's a sign-up for what's going to be there next. I don't remember what it is at the moment, but nevertheless. Do you remember, Matthew, what's going there next?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
So anyway, I think it is a limited run. It does seem most of those things are. But
my question is it seems like for this show that is getting good reviews and has a small cast and can manage themselves, plus they have a subscription audience, would they extend? Are they looking for a Tony Award? Is this a Tony contender? What do you think about how the season's stacking up?
Well, I'm sure it's a Tony contender for best play. I would be very surprised if it isn't. The question that you're asking, though, is very very interesting in terms of view from the bridge, which is a limited engagement and has to get out of its theater so that Denzel Washington and Fences can come in. And they're not happy about that. They would like to run longer. So we'll see what happens there, if indeed they will be able to eke out an extra bit of time. But it's really tight at the moment. They're going to have to get out of their theater so that Fences can load in April. So we'll see what happens.
Well, Michael Riedel had a column about this on Friday, and as I recall, he had suggested that one of the plays, I think, would go to the Fences would go to the Neil Simon, and that A View from the Bridge would take a month off to accommodate Scarlett Johansson's movie schedule, or she's promoting a movie, I believe, of some sort, and then it would reopen. And he quoted the producer saying, "Well, when you have reviews as good as this, you don't just close." And of course, that's certainly true if you can avoid it, but. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with the theater situation. And Liev Schreiber and Scarlett Johansson are kind of in-demand actors, so it's possible they might not be able to extend very much longer, but who knows?
Speaking of Scarlett Johansson, one of the things that I found very nice is the fact that she did get good reviews. And I'm sure there are people in Hollywood who tell other people in Hollywood, don't go to Broadway. They're going to kill you. They're going to do what they did to Julia Roberts. They're going to do what they did to Denzel Washington, D.C. They're going to say you're terrible, that you can't do it. Why do you bother? And the good reviews of Scarlett Johansson go against that. It does suggest that we are not just out to kill movie stars, that if they're good, we'll be the first ones to say so.
Well, of course, the good reviews of people like Hugh Jackman and Daniel Craig and other people like that also prove that it's not the name that we're looking for. It really is the talent. And as much as I like Julia Roberts on screen, she was not good in 3 Days of Rain. So
I'm all set there. I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm,
I don't have a problem with that. I think that I certainly wish that producers would remember as well as the other people that they might talk with in Hollywood, as you suggested. I wish they would remember that perhaps there needs to be a little bit more thought given to the appropriateness of the actor with the role and so on. So
no argument there.
Moving on, we talked a little bit about a traffic jam with houses on Broadway and shows trying to get into them. And the two of you have seen the third part of The Orphan's Home Cycle, which is rumored to be thinking about a transfer. So why don't you both talk about the third part. Peter, why don't you start?
I'm not sure that my reading of the third part has anything to do with anybody else's. I found this a very interesting play on a level that I haven't seen anybody talk about. And again, I haven't read all the reviews, so it's entirely possible everybody's came to this conclusion. But this is about a young boy who has gone through a terrible time. His mother didn't want him when she married another husband. His father died. He mourns the father. He's trying the best he can to get through life. One of the persons he loves doesn't wind up marrying him. He does wind up marrying a very nice person, and he's trying to start a life. But what was so interesting to me in this third play is that so many people were asking him questions and asking for advice, and what do you think I should do here? And almost every time he was asked to give his opinion on a life or death issue, or even a matter of fact issue, he would say, I don't know. Gee, I can't say. I guess you better decide. I mean, I just can't. And I really wondered if the point of the play was, if you have a kid like this who goes through this tough type of upbringing, that he can come through with a lack of confidence that prevents him from making decisions, from being a better and more self-actualized and successful person on each level. There is much made in the third part that he's not as successful, that he had a chance to take a chance and he didn't take the chance, and he is suffering for it. Some people won't let him forget that either. I did notice that many of the critics did say that part three wasn't as engrossing as parts one and two, and I do have to agree with that, but I still thought it was pretty good. It still held my attention.
Well, I would just say to Peter that it really is an interesting take on it, but I don't think the message was in any way that he wasn't successful, but that he was a different kind of success. Because one of the interesting things about part three is that the focus really starts to change from Horace, who is the lead character that we follow throughout the whole thing, to his brother-in-law, who has been living in the shadow of a very well-known and very powerful man in the town for a long time and is starting to rebel against that with really bad consequences all the way around. And they carry all the way through the third play and really affect the way things going or the way things happen until the literally the very last few minutes of the whole thing. So the point, I think, is showing that there are different kinds of success and there are different kinds of failure. And my personal reading of what Peter is referring to is that, well, what happens is that Horace is given a chance to go in on this very potentially lucrative investment deal that he passes up for a number of reasons, partially because he doesn't want to risk the money he has at stake in his suit store, which is not doing so well and which he is needed to take out loans for and so on. And it turns out that this investment deal ends up doing a lot of good for a lot of people. But I thought that what was being suggested without being outright stated was that because the play ends in 1928, the people who invested in that are about to take an enormous fall from which Horace will probably be spared because he's not going to have all of his money tied up in some bizarre, challenging investment when the stock market crashes. So I think that that was really sort of a big point showing that what looks like a bad choice at one time isn't necessarily going to be the wrong thing to do in the long run. And I did like that aspect of it.
Well, that's fascinating, Matthew. I have to admit that that didn't occur to me. On the other hand, too, I'm not quite sure that Horace will be in good shape when the Depression comes in the following year, because it is stated more than once that he has taken out a loan with the bank. And I think he's taken out a second or third one, certainly a second. And I wonder how that'll impact him when the Depression comes. But there are at least a couple of scenes where we see his store and with virtually no customers whatsoever. And he's really having a tough time of it. I wouldn't argue with you, Matthew. I think that's a very good reading on what it is.
No, you're right about that. But I think that the other part of that is that a big part of the third and the final play in the third evening is called The Death of Papa, which is really about the death of his wife's father, the one that the brother has been trying to escape from for the whole time. A big part of that is what happens to that father's investments in his land and all that. And part of what happens, unfortunately, is that the mother, who's played by Holly Foote, who's the playwright Horton Foote's daughter, part of what happens is that the brother fritters that all away and makes a lot of really bad mistakes that then compels the mother to turn to Horace as the kind of saving grace to pull things out of the fire. So again, it's all about interpretation. And my interpretation was that Horace is probably going to slowly transition over into that, and that that will be enough of a cushion that he may lose the store, but he's not going to just sort of implode when the stock market crashes. And the thing is, again, this is all supposition. There's not enough information in the play itself to support all this. And frankly, I think that's one of the problems with this evening, is it's not quite self-contained enough. I love the idea that there are questions and puzzles that you don't get all the answers to, because I don't think you need to have all the answers all the time. Mm-hmm. But I think that too much of the time, and I don't think this is necessarily a problem with the plays as they were originally written, but as they were edited down from whatever it was, 8 or 9 hours, the 3 hours that have to do with this play, I think that they might have lost a lot of the nuances and the plot points that would really have kind of fleshed all this out and helped more of it make sense. And this is the only evening of the Orphan's Home cycle where I felt like I was seeing the big red X's over the pages as the story was unfolding. The first of the three plays I thought was especially poor in that regard, because it's called 1918, and it contrasts what happens with the flu pandemic of that year with the final weeks and months of World War One, and showing how their lives are affected by both of those, and how Horace sort of comes to terms with his own family's death and his own relationship to it, and all that. And it's very interesting from that standpoint. But there's one scene where dozens of people are dying, and then they walk off, and then they come on stage and say, oh no, someone died 30 minutes ago. Can you hear the bells? Yes, there are the bells. Someone else comes on, oh, the war is over. Then they walk off and they come on and they say something else. And it happens a little bit too much. So I think that there is kind of a problem with the construction of the way that these plays have been compressed this time around that I didn't sense with the other two evenings. And for that reason, and the fact that there is just a little bit going on that doesn't receive the attention it should from the plot, I think that this is the weakest of the three Orphans Home Cycle evenings. And it makes me really sad, because I was expecting something really life-changing and transcendent, because the first two seem to be building up to really kind of an American mythical type of experience that they didn't deliver. It ends very low-key, almost too low-key, I think, for something that you've invested 9 hours in, and that really has covered an amazing span of American emotions and doesn't really quite tell you what it all adds up to as well as I think it probably should. So it's a shame from that standpoint, but even so, if you haven't seen any of the Orphans Home Cycle plays, and assuming tickets are still available, I have no idea. They're probably not, and they might not be until it goes to Broadway, if it actually goes to Broadway. But it's definitely worth seeing, because it's really an amazing achievement from someone who really has never suggested he was capable of doing this kind of work. And I wish that Horton Foote had lived to really complete the work on it. This helped smooth over all the rough edges from the kind of editing of the plays together. And that hopefully, if that had happened, maybe the whole thing would have ended up just a little bit more fulfilling than it quite did end. But as it was, there's really a lot of amazing stuff in the trilogy, and even in the third evening, which as Peter said, is good. It's not great. The other two are great, and this one isn't great. It's good, but there's enough stuff in here to really impress and to move and to really make you think about your own family and the way that the American landscape has changed over the last 100 years. So it's worth seeing. And if it goes to Broadway, I'll definitely be recommending it as a complete evening. But part three alone, I think, doesn't really stand by itself.
Well, there is something Matthew mentioned involving Hallie Foote playing the mother of this wastrel. And that's a fabulous moment when she tells Horace that she is going to allow him control of the money, because after all, that's her son. And you can tell from the way Hallie Foote is delivering this that this character knows that she is making a mistake, but there's nothing she can do because this is her son, and motherly love trumps good business sense under these circumstances. She'll come to regret it, and what's wonderful in the scene where she does come to regret it, she doesn't express shock. An amazing surprise. She knew it was coming. So it's a fascinating moment. And I don't know if there's been any playwright who's ever been blessed enough to have somebody so wonderful perform in his plays. But it certainly has happened here. It's a good father-daughter relationship. And she certainly keeps the legacy going.
I just wanted to add in here that Orphan's Cycle has been extended through Saturday, May 8th at Signature.
The tickets are $20, right?
Tickets,
am I right?
Tickets for the extension are $65.
I see. Were they $20?
So they were $20 for the original, and the extension will be $65 per part, they're saying.
Still a good deal.
Still a good deal.
And, it really is.
And so hopefully Signature will be able to recoup some money on this thing, because I can't imagine at $20 a ticket that they were even
more than 20 people in the cast.
Yeah, able to take care of their stuff. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was being underwritten by some corporation.
Sure.
That's how they can do it.
Sure.
And so, and this does always happen that if there's an extension, then the extension ticket prices are more in line with everything.
So, Peter, you saw a smudge off Broadway, and why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
This is a fascinating play. It really is the grandson of a play from the 60s called A Day in the Death of Joe Egg. Many of you might know that play because it's been revived a couple of times in New York since the 60s. Once to very good effect with Stockard Channing playing the mother of this severely developmentally disabled child. When you have a child like this, of course, it's a tragedy, but when you live with it day to day, it doesn't take long before you also have to find some release through humor. And that's what happens in Joe Egg. And of course, what happens in the second act of Joe Egg is that a couple of friends come over for dinner and they're astonished at how the occasionally the parents will make a joke about their child. But the implication is, yeah, if you lived with it, you'd be doing that too. Smudge is about a far more severely impacted child. It's I'll give you a couple of lines in the play to indicate the type of thing I mean. The mother says, I know you think it's a girl, but I mean, I'm pretty sure it's a boy. I mean, isn't that a penis? No, I think that's a leg. You know, so this is really a very severely impacted child, if it can be considered a child. It really is a freak of nature, one of those things that happens every now and then, and happily doesn't happen more often than it happens. It's very sad to see a baby carriage on stage with a dozen tubes coming out of it, a big machine underneath it. The clicking sound never stops throughout the entire 90 minutes of the show. Click, click. It's a Chinese water torture of sorts, but this is what these people have to live with. A beeping goes off every now and then, too. So it deals with what's interesting about the play is this is the type of play where you've heard the expression, a face that only a mother could love. No, the mother is far less enthusiastic about what's happened than the father, who is intent on saying, this is my child. We are going to love this child. And both of them come to meet in the middle by the time the play ends, that each of them sees that we can't pretend that this is just a child to love the way the father wants to. And the mother also realizes the poor thing, she has to give it some attention. She doesn't even want to look at it. I mean, when she uses the word she always crooks her fingers like making quotation marks. Well, she, quotation marks with the fingers, needs to be fed. Cassie Beck, who, by the way, was the Theatre World Award winner some years ago, plays the part really well. It's a very effective piece of theater, and I know there's no way I can make it sound appealing or make it sound that it's funny without being mocking, and yet there is something about the mood that draws you in and keeps you there and doesn't make you disgusted or repulsed or anything like that. So I think it's a very skillful piece of work and is worth seeing if you don't even have to have that strong a stomach for it, oddly enough. It really does its work amazingly well.
And that's at the Women's Project. On 55th.
Between 9th and 10th, what used to be called Theater 4, where Boys in the Band played many years ago.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Next thing I wanted to talk about briefly for a few seconds is the Pasadena Playhouse is running into some financial straits here and is looking that like it's going to shut down. I've never been to the Pasadena Playhouse. I was wondering if either one of you have been out there.
I have. You, Matthew?
I have too, yeah.
What did you see there?
I went there in May of 2002 to see the West Coast premiere of A Class Act, directed by Lonnie Price and starring Robert Picardo. So that's the only time I've been there. I have to say, though, I was considering going out there to see Camelot. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get there by next weekend, but it's kind of an intriguing thing they're doing with the eight-person
small allot.
Camelot. Yeah. So I don't know. I have a flight voucher I might try to redeem for that, but I just don't know if I'm going to have time. It's really too bad if they're closing down. It's a wonderful space, but
State Theater of California.
It's a beautiful theater. It really is. It evokes a marvelous mythic type of almost cathedral-like experience in there. It seems church-like. And I was only in once, too. I saw Sister Act there a couple of years ago before it headed off to London. So Well, you know, I remember when the Paper Mill Playhouse looked as if it was going to close down in Millburn, yeah. New Jersey, and they were able to keep it afloat. And one of the things they did was sell the building to the town. The town now owns the Paper Mill Playhouse, not the Paper Mill Playhouse itself, which used to. And I don't know if that's the case with the Pasadena Playhouse, if it owns its own property or what. But if it does, that would be a nice way out to sell it to the town, because it's a valuable asset to the town. Millburn, New Jersey knows that nobody's going to be going to Millburn, New Jersey, or to any of those restaurants that do awfully well if there's no Paper Mill Playhouse. Similarly speaking, yes, Pasadena has the Rose Bowl. There's no question about it. And there are more visitors who go there as a destination. But still, that playhouse has been around for a number of decades. And as a result, it would be a tremendous loss to the community. And we all have to hope that such a beautiful building and such a hallowed location and history will be enough to keep it going.
Well, it says here in the article on Playbill that it was established in 1917. And it's interesting that you bring up the Sister Act thing, because we talked about Sister Act last week, and that we hadn't heard anything about it coming to Broadway. And Whoopi Goldberg made the announcement this week that it is coming to Broadway.
Oh.
And so,
did she say that on The View?
I don't know if she said it on The View. But she made an announcement that she... that Sister Act is coming to Broadway. I'm not sure what her role in it is, if she's just trumpeting it or if she's going to be a producer or what's happening there. But Sister Act is coming to Broadway, and perhaps because the Pasadena Playhouse did the world premiere in conjunction with the Alliance Theater, maybe there's some revenue to be had that can go back in some small way and
maybe there is. I'm thinking of American Stage Company in Teaneck, New Jersey, which gave birth to I Love You, You're Perfect Now Change, and nevertheless went out of business. And I really feel bad about that, because that theater took a chance on that show when nobody else would. Believe me, that show was dead in the water. And Jim Vias, who ran the theater, believed that I Love You, You're Perfect Now Change was an audience pleaser, and he was certainly proved right time and time and time and time and time again, here, there, and everywhere all over the globe. I know it's played Barcelona, among many, many other foreign cities. And unfortunately, it didn't do that theater as much good. Now, granted, I Love You, Perfect Now Change was an off-Broadway show, and Sister Act is clearly going to be a Broadway show, and so therefore much more money will be available. I don't know what the terms are, of course, of what the Pasadena Playhouse's financial cut will be of it, but I always thought it was very sad that American Stage Company and Teaneck didn't benefit enough to keep that theater afloat when a show that it really made happen kept going.
So Michael Riedel's Friday column that just passed was very much focused on the Addams Family. I went to hear a panel where Michael was on at Situation Events this week, just passed, and he could not say enough things in the negative about Addams Family, which is very sad, because I was really pretty much looking forward to it coming. And as we've mentioned before, Michael's usually got his finger on the pulse of things to happen. So we're the article says that they're going back into rehearsals with Jerry Zaks at the helm on Monday, and we'll see what happens a little bit later on.
Gee, I don't know. I mean, of course, I haven't seen it, and I will admit that everybody I know who's seen it hasn't been that enthusiastic about it. But I'll go out on a limb and say I think it's the show to beat at the Tonys. I think it has the best chance of being a Tony winner, because it strikes me as the type of show that will appeal to the rest of America, while some of the other shows that will be nominated this year will not have as much strength on the road. So I think it's going to turn out all right. And having been a veteran of Boston tryouts from way back when, I saw shows really work so hard to become successful and do it. The biggest example that I can really think of, which in the early 80s was My One and Only, which got terrible reviews in Boston, and the people just would not let it die. Everyone associated said, we are going to work on this, we're going to fix it. And I'm telling you, I was at the opening at the St. James at that first performance, and the one thing that was so amazing about that show was it never looked as if it could have possibly ever have been in trouble. It was that much of a smash hit that night. And I mean, to watch Tommy Toon and Twiggy arm in arm looking out that audience going crazy and thinking, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we were this big flop. I have a feeling Addams Family is going to pull itself together and be quite a success. So I'll go out on a limb and say that.
The interesting aspect of Michael Riedel's column for me was that he was saying that Nathan Lane was really kind of taking charge of what was happening and really pushing to get things to go in the proper funny direction that the show needed to go in. And I do generally agree that Nathan Lane's instincts for comedy are very good, but I'm reminded of the revival of The Frogs that Lincoln Center did in 2004 that really was not particularly satisfying and that Nathan Lane wrote the new book to. So I think there are reasons to be optimistic and there are reasons to be pessimistic. And I certainly agree that I would love it for the show to succeed. I mean, it's got a wonderful cast and a lot of potential, but it's way too early to tell. I think we'll have to see what sort of change Jerry Zaks can affect on it, and hopefully it'll be a good one.
We'll have to leave it just like the Apple's iPad, and we won't know until it's in our hands with whether we like it or not.
Yes, indeed.
Something new that I'd like to talk about every couple of weeks is people that we want to see back on Broadway, and Peter, why don't you start us off?
Well, I'll come up with a name that I came up with a little earlier in a different context, and that's Stalker Channing. It's always fun to see her on stage. She does come back every now and then, and usually to good advantage. Certainly in Six Degrees of Separation, maybe less so as Regina and the Little Foxes, where I thought she'd be better. But nevertheless, I'm enthusiastic about her because I saw her when she was an undergraduate at, a graduate student, actually, when in her days on the Harvard Radcliffe campus, where she appeared in quite a few shows. Luca in Arms and the Man, marvelous. The Girl in the Lesson, terrific. A musical called Peace with Steve Hannon. He was Steve Kaplan then. Steve Hannon, who's best known as the Gus the Theater Cat from the original cast of Cats. So Stalker Channing, whenever I see that she's coming back to Broadway, I always say, good. I'm looking forward to that. So that's the first person that comes to mind for me.
You know, I am a little bit of a television junkie, but only for a handful of shows. And somebody who keeps on popping up again on my favorite shows is Jennifer Westfeldt, who I'm very, very fond of. She was in Wonderful Town on Broadway a few years back, and I've seen her in a few things off Broadway. But she's starring in 24 now, and she's been on Grey's Anatomy and Private Practice last season. I think it was that she was on that, and she's been working steadily out in Hollywood for a number of years ever since she got her own film Kissing Jessica Stein off the ground. So she's working a lot, and you can catch her on 24 all this season. She's one of the main characters on this season's storyline. So have you seen Jennifer in any shows, Peter?
Just in A Lifetime Burning at 59 East 59th Street. But I'll tell you, I am a great fan of the Kissing Jessica Stein movie. I don't think it's just because Jennifer was a Theatre World Award winner and Tova Felcher, who plays her mother, is a Theatre World Award winner, or because Jackie Hoffman, who plays one of her best friends at work, is a Theatre World Award winner. It's a nice little movie, and if you haven't seen it, it's something I really urge you to see. It's based on a play that was done off Broadway called Lipstick. And it is about a woman who has had so many bad dates with guys that just this once she'll try answering an ad that a woman places. And it's a sweet little movie. The way Tova Felcher indicates that it's okay for her daughter to be having an affair with a woman is astonishingly skillful writing. And I urge you to see that. So I know she's doing very well. I know she's running around with John Hamm, who's doing very well in Mad Men. And wouldn't it be nice if they came back together and maybe did Private Lives? Who knows?
This is perhaps not the most exciting or original choice in the entire world, but I would love to see Audra McDonald come back on Broadway, preferably in a new musical. The last thing she did was 110 in the Shade, and she was fantastic in that.
Yes, she was.
Before that, she was fantastic in A Raisin in the Sun, and before that, she was fantastic in Henry IV, and before that, she did Marie Christine in Ragtime, which I didn't see, and Masterclass, and of course, Carousel. She's really a wonderful musical performer, and I have never seen her in Private Practice, but James, you've talked on a recent podcast about how wonderful she is in a recent episode. I don't doubt for a minute that she's great, but I don't think that having her bottle up her God-sent voice on a regular basis is really good for anybody. So I would love to see her come back to Broadway in either a new play or a new musical that's written for her that would really let her show off the wide range of her talents that maybe she isn't able to demonstrate every week on her TV show.
Isn't it Michael John Lacusa who's just her biggest fan, and he talks about writing shows for her?
Well, he wrote one for her. I mean, he wrote Marie Christine for her. And actually, he did an opera too. I think it was called Send I Love You or something like that. That was a one-woman piece that he wrote.
Done in Houston, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, for the most part, yeah. I mean, frankly, I wouldn't mind seeing Michael John Lacusa come back to Broadway either, although, of course, as a writer and not as a performer. But he has always seemed to have found his bigger or biggest successes as it is off Broadway. So maybe it's best if he doesn't for the time being. But yeah, Audra McDonald is a wonderful performer, and she just can't do enough stage stuff for my taste. She did come back last summer to do 12th Night Up in the Park, which was incomparable, and not just because of her, but because everyone in it was so well cast and so well directed, and the music was so wonderfully composed. So she can come back once in a while, but like I said, she just doesn't come back often enough for me.
Tom Conti, we haven't seen him in a long time. And he was so good in Whose Life Was It Anyway? And very good in the movie version of a play called Spofford. The movie was called Reuben, which was the original name of the novel on which Spofford was based. Very talented performer. We haven't seen him in a long time. I wish we could see him again.
We have our wish list in, and maybe somebody listening will be inspired enough to
and put them all together
them.
In one show. Yeah, that's just
exactly.
I think that would be a very good idea.
And so with that, I guess we'll wrap up the evening. And I just want to remind everybody that you can get these podcasts automatically by subscribing to them on iTunes. If you would like, go to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side under the Broadway Radio section, there's a subscribe button. That way, every time we have a new show, it'll download automatically to your favorite player of sorts that's connected to iTunes. If you want to reach out and let us know who you want to have come back to Broadway, please drop us a line. There's a contact form right above the subscribe button on Broadway Stars, or you can give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 646-873-7695. So on behalf of Matthew Murray and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.
When he looks at me, everything's hazy and all out of focus. When he touches me, I'm in the spell of a strange hocus pocus. It's so, I don't know, I'm so, I don't know, but I know if it's love, then it's lovely. It's so nice to be alive when you meet someone who bewitches you.